Accession number 4662, rental number 4.
Anderson, Reel 4. Would you continue, please, with your description of the airfield and station at Mbala?
Yes, from our living quarters, we had to step outside across a pipeline. I think this supplied fresh water to all the, right along the line of billets for the army, etc., all the service people. On this raised portion, built in, obviously the pipe was above ground, but cased in with bricking. We sit out there in the cool of an evening to talk and discuss, and many a chap used to have called a session out on the pipeline with a bucket of bottles of beer and carry on our talking over a bottle of beer. It's quite a good way of spending a hot evening, which much cooler there probably than in the bungalows. Anyway, from over that, you step over that, in one corner, it was the airfield really, but just in one corner over the pipeline was our soccer pitch, where we had many a game, and the rest was a huge, what to me it seemed, huge airfield. Normal, during normal weather, that is summer weather, which is mostly hot weather there, this used to be a vast mass of hard mud, you might call it, mutty as the Hindu word or Urdu word, and the vegetation on there had all died and left a lot of spikes, seeds, we call chubby dusters. They stuck in our plimsoll soles and in rubber soles, shoes. They actually made a mess of them on the soles, feet, and impossible even for dogs to cross there. They tried to cross the sphere, feel the compass across the technical side. They'd probably get one in one paw and carry on three legs, look at another one, another leg, and they had to give up until somebody came and pulled them out of his pads. There were masses of these things, and we used to crunch as we walked along. And that was during the summer season. Of course, soon the monsoon started, the Summerson monsoon. I can't quite recollect referring to my diaries when the summer monsoon began, but it must have been towards the middle of the summer or towards the late summer. And then it really began to rain. You could see the dark clouds in the distance, probably a front coming up with a wind. With the sand and dust being raised after months of dry weather, there'd be a massive dust, like a dust storm starting, coming in the distance. You see this brown cloud high in the sky coming along. We knew the monsoon was going to strike us any moment. In a few minutes, the monsoon would be with us, and it would. This wind would be ahead of it, and with all this sun, and followed by sand in the air, followed by the rain. And it used to come down in really sheets of rain, really heavy rain. And this, the airfield then, of course, would be next to no time flooded in one morning or one afternoon. It would be absolutely flooded under 3 or 4 inches of rain, and which gave us some fun sometimes. We used to go snake hunting because the airfield was infested with cobra, black cobra, and crates and such like snakes, both very poisonous, and various other varieties of bigger snakes, but probably, I don't know whether they're harmless or not, but they look fearsome enough. And we used to go out snake hunting because a snake couldn't breathe underwater. And they used to come out from the holes in the ground with their nostrils just above the ground, breathing. And if you walked across, you'd just see two nostrils above the water surface. So we decided one day, while we were at work in the morning, to make forked sticks out of mild steel and bound these on the end of bamboo poles or any stick to hold of. And that afternoon we went out snake hunting. Of course, in the morning, soon the monsoon started, you were quite occupied at work, pushing snakes off or flicking them back into the water again as they came for the dry ground around our technical area and such like, or even in the bungalows, they used to try and come up the stairs. But we went definitely out snake hunting, because the first we heard it, we thought it was very difficult, but found it so utterly simple. All you had to do is watch for these two nostrils breathing and go up to the hole, and of course the snake would go into reverse and disappear into the hole, because he couldn't hold his breath for more than, say, 3 minutes. All he had to do was put a forked stick across the hole, and as he came up to take a deep breath, he just jabbed him in the neck, and probably got a jackknife or such like, and just pushed it in and pulled him out. And they had a cobra there for the asking almost. We used to do it for fun once or twice, but we wasn't got tired of that very soon. Probably one season of that, it's a novelty, and he didn't trouble anymore. He just let them be. But they were quite dangerous. And over the one snake charmer who came one down the airfield to collect snakes, and he got bitten and took him to the sick bay, but they couldn't revive him, he died. At night time, nobody would go out of the billets without a torch. We would want to go to the canteen, always had a torch shining on the ground in front of one. You never knew where they would be. And the charwallas and the natives and the night watchmen always carried a lantern so they could see a circle around them so they wouldn't tread on one or approach one. No, a snake won't attack, they'll disappear as soon as they hear a noise, but you never know, a sleeping one, you may step too near it. And of course they will attack if they are frightened. But on the whole, well, we just took precautions not to get near them. Anyway, as soon as the monsoon started, the grass would begin to grow at an enormous rate. And within a week or so, say a week, it'd be knee high quite easily, with thick green grass. Then the monsoon would start and the sun would continue. Then the atmosphere used to be almost suffocating humidity on the airfield. It's all right round the bungalows or such like. Probably the grass didn't have time to settle there, but on the airfield itself, on one occasion I had to walk out to look for a hurricane lamp that had been used for night flying. We put up paraffin flares at night in the line, about four or five paraffin flares with two red lights to indicate the beginning of the touchdown point and the end of the touchdown point. And one lamp had gone out during the night and we couldn't find it, and I was sent out the following day to go and look for it. But walked about 100 yards or less into this thick grass with the steam absolutely literally rising from this long grass. I had to give it up and say I couldn't find it. It's impossible to go and search amongst that grass, and also the fear of the odd snake being in that grass, both combined. Though mostly at work I wore boots and putties for that particular reason. Wearing putties and boots were fairly safe from snake bite. That was another precaution. Though on the whole, aerodrome or the airfield was fairly short or no grass at all, but just during that period it died off as soon as the sun came along. But as I say, the airfield was just outside, or began more or less outside our living quarters, and stretched across, I don't know how far it would be, diagonally across one corner more or less to the technical site, where we had one large corrugated hangar and a petrol building where they store the petrol tanks underground, pumped up by hand into portable bowsers where the coolies wheel to the aircraft, to pump into the aircraft. And also there would be the armament section, the headquarters building, the photography section, the wireless section. All the technical side of an airfield would be in this sort of compound, and the guard room would be at that side of the airfield, away from the domestic site. And from there, well, that was occupied during the morning and during working hours that was occupied. But there's always a duty armourer who's in the armoury, I suppose, looking after the, or slept on the premises to look after the armoury and guard it more or less. And there's always a guard mounted in the afternoon for night duty. In that site where one stood on guard, did your normal 2 hours on, 4 hours off, and you could rest in between the stints. And they used to have a night watchman, used to patrol, a native watchman used to patrol round and about with his lantern, and used to report every so often, every 2 hours or so. And to show he'd reported, he put a pad of paper, and used to put his thumbprint on the time he had reported, so to show that he was awake. And also on the domestic site, used to have a native watchman there, and also airmen would detail the duty prowlers. We had to prowl around during the night at odd times to make certain the watchman was awake. But duty was taken very seriously, because I think the watchman would indicate that they were awake. You could hear the prowler coming, would start coughing, so indicate that he was awake. So I don't know whether they coughed in their sleep or not. You never could catch them out. That was the training, flying side, and the training side, photography section, armament section, all, and a blacksmith shop, do the odd blacksmith's work on the aircraft, or anything on, in, on the mechanical transport yard as well. So it was quite a beehive of activity there during the working hours. And also at this time, I began training as a wireless operator air gunner. I'd been a wireless operator, which meant quite a lot of flying, but one didn't get paid for it. The establishment was for 12 paid flying men, and they had to be air gunners, 12 air gunners, whether they were armourers, fitters, riggers. But the policy was to strike a balance. Each flight of four aircraft used to have one fitter air gunner, one rigger air gunner, one armament air gunner, and one wireless operator air gunner. So you had one of each trade. If the flight went away on detachment anywhere, you had a rigger, you had a fitter, you had a, an armourer looking after the guns, and you had a wireless operator for communications. So that was the policy. So I was attached to one flight. I mean, there's only one vacancy for a wireless operator eventually becoming an air gunner, and due to postings, I filled that vacancy and began training. Well, I began training as an air gunner before the vacancy became available, and this consisted of, in addition to fitting all the wireless sets, etc., to knowing a Lewis gun. I had to go to the armory where they gave lectures, or the armament flight sergeant would lecture you and show you the how the workings of the Lewis gun, and probably became efficient. You got on the firing butts to fire the Lewis gun. And you learn how the mechanism, how to strip it down, how to clear stoppages. This is quite a course, and you've got to know the gun quite well and its limitations. Then you have to do any duty they want in the air, such as photography. You had to know your cameras that were used at the time. When I first went there in Bristol Fighters, we had plate cameras. That's both vertical and oblique. The oblique, you stood up in the cockpit, braced yourself against the gun ring, held the camera against the slipstream, and took over the side of the aircraft. Usually, purposes would be for close reconnaissance targets or such like, but you used to fly around, the pilot used to detail any particular point of interest, photographs of that. I've still got my photograph album, the very first photograph I ever took, an oblique photograph of the hangar and the Bristol Fighters in the foreground. And it's quite a good photograph, and it's quite a good effort for the very first time. Got it central, got it level, and without shake, which is quite an achievement all at once in the first photograph. And the vertical ones were high-altitude photography, where one pilot flew on a steady course, and you took a strip, and came back the next strip to it, took a mosaic, in other words, a mosaic photography of the ground or anything in particular interest. And these were purely mechanical. No electrical devices at all to help one. You had to do it by stopwatch at certain intervals in your photograph, and you had to pull a lever connected to the camera by a Bowden cable, which moved the plate from the baking position to a slide along above a metal magazine. It dropped into the magazine, and so on. Next one dropped on top of that one till you'd finish your plates, the glass plates, of course, glass plates. And before you took the camera out of the aircraft, you had to put a safety cover into the magazine, or you could move the magazine and be light tight to take to the photography section for developing. And it has been known, though I've never done it myself, is forget to put the Descartes magazine in position, and you could happily, the air guns are going on taking photographs, and each plate's just dropped into the air and as went along, leaving the trails all like confetti behind the half-glass plates behind him. But then, of course, you're not very popular when you finish an exercise and you've got nothing to show for it. So that's one of the things. I'd be very careful in doing that type of work. But later on, when we were re-equipped with the aircraft to come to later, we had electrical control. Just as long as you set it all up properly, it was film on a roll. All we had to do was to get the interval correct on the indicator and switch on electricity, and it would do it all automatically and just put it off to go back for the next run to the strip you want to take, and so on. But the oblique cameras still carried on more or less the same, but still having plates, they went to film as well, and I think they were lighter.
Did you do any bomb dropping?
Yes, the air gunner's job is also bomb aiming. You had to learn your bomb sight, which is a very simple one on the Bristol Fighters. It was screwed onto a plate on the side of the aircraft. You just stood up in the rear cockpit, looked over the side through your bomb sight, and tapped the pilot on the shoulder, go left, tapped on the right shoulder, go right, and top of the head, carry straight on. And this, I learnt this in about 5 minutes one particular day. They were aircraft ready to take off on a camera, on a bombing exercise. The exercise should be carried out by flying over a camera obscura hut. It's a small building, brick building, with a lens in the roof. And on a paper, on a table beneath the lens, would be a sheet of paper pinned on the table, and the centre would be the target. Centre of the paper, corresponding to the centre of the lens above, would be the target. And aircraft flying overhead would be reflected on this sheet of paper. And there used to be have a metronome there, ticking away the seconds or whatever time interval they used. Every tick on a tock used to make a cross. That would give the track of the aircraft, not the course, the track of the aircraft actually going over the ground. With Bristol fighters, with this bomb site we had, we only could bomb approximately into wind or downwind, mostly into wind, because you didn't have any allowance for drift on the site. So it had to be done into wind, and even then, if you had a slight out of wind, you plot the track of the aircraft, because the bomb will fall along the track and not the course. And you either usually fired a very light pistol to indicate bomb away, and that would show on this paper as a little bright light and a puff of smoke, sort of brown on the reflection, and they'd mark the time of bomb drop. Then would be probably along the track or somewhere. It would be along the track. It would have to be if at the moment it's fired, and then they'd plot the time of fall of a bomb. They calculate the time of fall of a bomb at Dake, whatever, say, bombing at 6,000 feet. We didn't go much higher than for practice bombing at 6,000 feet in Bristol fighters. And then they used to, the armourer used to track the fall of a bomb, and then how long would Dake reach the ground, and mark a cross there and measure that to the target. That'd be your bombing error. And you used to do quite a number of runs that way.
What's the difference between track and course?
Course is the compass course with the course the aeroplane's flying. If you've got a wind to one side, you're going slightly to one side, you're following the wind. So you're not covering the ground on your course. So course is actually the compass heading. The nose of the aircraft is pointing on your course. If you've got a very strong side wind, you're going slightly sideways as well. And that's tracking, that's the amount of track. But that's used quite a lot at taking into account navigation. You must allow for your wind speed and direction, and you know your course on, say, on a map, and then you've got to work out what your track will be and compensate for that in your compass. So your compass will compensate for any difference in for wind direction, speed and direction. So a bomb will fall more or less on the track of the aircraft, and not on its course. And slightly behind due to wind resistance, would be slightly behind. Though you can see it when you're flying. In later years, when I flew, I could look between my feet, between the rudder bars, look down at the ground, watch where the bomb actually drops when the bomb aimer's released his bomb. Anyone can relax after a steady run. Still, that's a later part of my experience. But I was called to do this in 5 minutes' notice, and. You only had to set the height and allow for a little bit of get your drift on these to allow for any get your heading. You could do that when the air you have to grab that drift bar on it, so give you a heading for get into wind. That means some slight adjustment to whatever the pilot thought it would be. And it didn't take long to learn that. I was told that in 5 minutes for a flight one day, that you're going to be an air gunner, you've got to use the sight, here it is, you do this, that and the other, in you get, and off you go. It's almost like that. That's where I started my bombing career. Because you'd learn it later on in lectures and things. You knew more what was being done, what was trying to be achieved. So that was another exercise. I did as an air gunner with bombing. And then, of course, we did live bombing as well, dropping practice bombs or old bombs, the 20-pound anti-personnel bombs. You drop those. Sometimes the stock got a little bit old. And getting probably dangerous, being to exude a little bit of the amatol filling, And then we'd go and drop those as an exercise over the bombing range, over a bombing range nearby, where they'd have observers getting, you know, with get a bearing on the bomb, and from that they can plot how far it was from the target. And then message picking up, which I've gone to before, that's also an air gunner's job, or anybody who they like to tell got me to do this. It's a simple job, but it's really an air gunner's job, or whoever's flying as an air gunner. And I'm trying to think of other jobs, photography air gunnery.
As an air gunner, did you do any exercises with fighter attacks?
No, we never had fighter attacks. We used to do mostly against each other. As an air gunner, we had camera guns in the form of an imitation Lewis gun, but it had films. And probably an aircraft would dive on one. They didn't do actual sort of aerial combat, both aircraft fighting. One would fly straight, the other one would probably make quarter attacks or rear attacks, something like that, on it. And you had to use your camera gun and aim, of course, ahead of an aircraft. You had to judge how far ahead owing to your sight, which you had to imagine as a sphere. It's rather quite complicated air sighting like that. Because you've got to aim, if the aircraft's really at parallel with you and it's going 100 miles an hour, you've got to aim a certain distance in front of it for 100 miles an hour. Or if the pistol flies, do about 85 probably. You have to aim that distance in front. But if it's coming, say, a quarter view, you want to be about a quarter of that distance. So if you're going, say, a quarter attack, or half that distance, you have to aim in front. So you've got to judge whatever angle the aircraft was coming, you have to judge how far ahead of it you had to fire, leave time for the bullet to arrive at the aircraft at the correct time. And that was all done by ring sight and by examination of the photographs you took of the attack. It takes a long time to explain the theory, but it's quite complicated. With the front gun, it was the same in those days, where you just had a ring. It's called a 100-mile-an-hour ring. Then it was parallel with you. You just got the aircraft on the outer ring at 100 yards, say that, and they would meet the aircraft, and the bullet would meet. That's in this most simple position. But after that, of course, you never have that. It's always a variation of that, as the arrow angle narrows, or unless you're dead astern, of course, and you just aim, or something astern of you, or you ahead of a target, then of course it's just straight aiming, then you don't allow for any deflection at all. But those situations are probably in more modern warfare that did occur quite a lot, straight firing, either both coming ahead or on the tail of someone. But in those days, aircraft were slower, and of course, they could turn in tighter circles. In a way, it was more difficult than high speed. Though I'd never done any real high speed flying, but by comparison, I should imagine straight firing, of course, could have a steadier nerve probably. But it was quite interesting. You had to be on thinking the whole time. It's not a matter of pointing a camera. You could point in the right position all the time, and that applied to front gunning. Had cameras for the front gun as well, where they either took one photograph, you dived at the target, or in later camera guns you had a cine film. So as you dived, your film lasts as long as your burst, say a burst of 2 or 3 seconds. They show 2 or 3 seconds of film of one's target. But in our rather primitive days of Bristol fighters, it was just one exposure on a reel of film.
While in India, you would be in other stations as well as your main base.
Yes, this comes a rather interesting point. There were stations on the Northwest Frontier, bomber stations, with two squadron stations, two squadrons at Rizalpur and two squadrons at Kahat up on the Northwest Frontier. And also another army cooperation squadron at Peshawar on the northwest frontier. And there was other RAF stations, such as Quetta, a maintenance depot, or a stores depot, one at Lahore, which was the headquarters, another one at Delhi, which is sort of another headquarters and wireless station at Delhi. That was the command headquarters at Delhi. But the flying stations were the... But those were the only ones. Ambala, for the Army Corporation down the main part of India, and the five up in the northwest frontier. And during the summer, we were sent to our hill station for approximately 6 to 7 weeks each year for intensive ground training in drill, foot drill, rifle drill, fire rifle course. And this happened every morning at the hill station, and this is where all the squadrons met. You met your next door neighbours, or think they were never met them normally during the year, but once a year you all gathered together a party. The squadrons were divided into three parties of 6 weeks each, and each squadron or station sent a party to the hill station. So we had all the five or six squadron headquarters and such like all there, which made a very competitive spirit for drill and for sports amongst the various squadrons in the hills. And of course you met many old friends developed over the years or seen over the years out there. And first thing in the morning had a drill parade, which meant in drill uniform or best uniform for the morning parade. Be inspected, then first few weeks you go through a complete drill course in that 6 weeks. Start off foot drill, stick drill, then onto rifle drill, all the ceremonial drills, funeral drill, and so by the time you finish those 6 weeks, you once again you're a smart airman, knew all your drill, you kept one on your toes and kept one up to date with drill, and also kept one fit and occupied. Then after drill, that first period of drill in the morning, next part of the program in the morning probably broke off for a cup of tea, but then say another after that everybody had to disperse. People on all air gunners went to either gunnery lectures or bombing lectures, where you did a real 6 weeks intensive course on your air fire, on firing your guns, on your theory of bombing and bomb composition, how to fuse bombs, defuse them, and your ammunition, and finish off doing a firing or a machine guns or Lewis guns on the range. And also we all did a rifle course on the range as well. We had to qualify on the rifle range, get a certain standard. If you didn't reach that standard, you were sent back for more training in aiming, handling a rifle with Morris tubing it, where you fired 2-2 ammunition on the corner of the parade ground, and then back to the full range again to try again if you'd failed, until you could be a good rifle shot. You couldn't leave the hill station without being a good rifle shot, unless you were absolutely hopeless and they gave you up as a bad job. But on the average, every man was a good shot. And then, as I say, people went to armament courses, to the range, to lectures they're doing, higher educational, advanced educational courses or promotion courses, various lectures with civilian instructors. Would instruct, especially the advanced educational, the higher educational certificate, we used to call it higher educational training, which is equivalent, supposed to be the old matriculation. It was allowed equal to that for any professional examination, which is quite tough. I tried it myself, but I couldn't cope. Now I think mechanics got me down, movements and things like that. I've never touched it before in my life. I've had commercial training and technical training, hadn't touched, and moments and weights and things and movements rather confused me, and I gave it up. It was beyond me, though English had helped me in English, and you had to know world affairs quite well and politics, especially Indian politics. It was quite an interesting course, but meant a lot of study. And then other people, pilots would go on the same courses, gunnery courses, the Vickers gun, and bomb and learn about their bombs as well, or refresh their memory about their bombs. And then all people without anything, any lectures or such like, went on what they called a dog and stick parade. all the dogs in the station, which are quite a number, because people who own dogs down in the stations on the plains and such like on the Northwest Frontier usually gave their dogs over to somebody on the first party who looked after them. They hand them over to somebody on the second party, and they hand them over to the third party. So all the dogs were in Europe, all the stations were concentrated in a place called Lower Taupo in the Murray Hills, which is a lovely place about 7,000 feet above sea level. And they all had to go out for this dog and stick parade, take the dogs out. So it wasn't the dog, it wasn't the airman who wasn't on duty in the camp by the mid-morning break. So a stream of dogs left the camp to wander about the hills or go to the local native village, about probably a couple of miles away, where you could go for a feed if you wanted to, or a cup of coffee or tea, and or buy anything if you want to do a bit of shopping. An opportunity to do a bit of shopping in the Indian bazaar, as we call the little townships, bazaars. And again, when I was in air gunner training, of course I stayed behind and did lectures, but for the first year, or maybe the first couple of years, probably the first year only, because I used to go on the dog and stick parades, and I didn't take a dog, though sometimes I've got photographs taken with dogs, but usually somebody else with a dog, they'd follow. And it used to be delightful climbing amongst the hills, amongst the pine trees. Nothing was flat there. It was really almost a peak, Lower Taupo, the peak, and roads radiated. Well, only one road went into Kashmir, and the other one into a town nearby township. Quite a long walk, or sometimes you could hire horses, get on a horse and go there. But it wasn't far walking across the side of the hill. If you went by horse, you had to go by the main road. If you walked, you could go along the hillside and a windy, twisty road, and. That used to be our main outings there, but I enjoyed going to the cinema in, it was Murray itself, the town was Murray, of all the Murray Hills, go to the cinema there. It was quite a treat to go to a cinema and probably have a meal.